everyone for being here. It's pretty early here in Montreal. It's like 6 a.m. in the morning. Yeah, with 5 kids at home, it was quite a challenge being here on time. So
my God,
my hairs are still wet and that's okay. I'll just deal with it. So we're going to start today with Bibiana. So Bibiana, you're going to share your own poster
about
the diagnosis of a urban district. So
Okay. So hello, I'm Viviana Contreras. I'm a primary care physician in Caplas Cors in Barcelona. And first of all, I need to say that during these 2 days, I have been hearing and listening to your speeches from people who work in universities and in public agencies of the government or administration. And you know a lot about salutogenics. I am learning too much, but I'm just a primary care physician. I feel very small comparing with you. I mean, I'm just an amateur because my day-by-day is visiting patients, one patient every 10 minutes. And I'm just interested in community health, and we try to work on it in our district, but I don't know so much as you. And the second thing is, sorry for my English, I haven't used it for years. I will try to do my best, okay? and now I will try to share, because it's the first time I share a screen. I think that here and here, okay. And now with this. Okay, so I present a study we made in our neighborhood with two primary care centers in our district, the community health work group of the two primary care centers, and it's titled Community Diagnosis of an Urban District. With this study, we wanted to detect health problems from a biopsychosocial point of view, perceived by the community, in order to carry out improvement actions. For make this, we made a quantitative study. We analyzed the data published on the official website of the public health agency of the city. And for the qualitative study, we made 20 interviews of 60 minutes following the rapid participatory appraisal, which is recommended by the WHO for small territories. And then we made a thematic, an inductive thematic analysis, assigning levels and categories. And after that, we made a thematic prioritization globally and according to age groups. With this information, we got a provisional list of priority problems to be presented to the Neighborhood Community Health Board that was scheduled for March of the last year, but was finally canceled due to the pandemic. And we are going to try it for October. We have now a new date. And the results we got with this study, community detected as general problems in our district: pollution, public transportation, and house prices. And by age groups, in childhood, the lack of public services such as nursery, schools, or playgroups; in youth, the toxic consumption; in adults, the increase in mental health problems; and in elderly, loneliness and lack of public residences and day centers. And well, now we have still pending the creation of the formal work group, the approval of the list of needs, and the prioritization where community could define what needs are more important and participate in improvement actions together, community and professionals, in order to make what this conference says, that is advancing salutogenesis toward thriving societies. And well, that's all. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. That's very interesting. 3 minutes and you can share all of these very valuable knowledge. So thank you very much.
Welcome.
So I propose we go through all of the posters and then after have some questions, since it's so short, each of them. So the second one would be from Ruth. Ruth, you want to share your pre-recorded or you want me to do it for you?
Could you please do it for me? Melissa?
Yeah, I hope it's gonna work. Okay, so I'll press play and then we'll listen to you.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Grossi Milani. I am a psychologist, professor in the postgraduate programs in health promotion and in clean technology at the University Center of Maringá, Southern Brazil. I coordinate the research group on mental health. The research I will present was prepared by Eduardo Cherrito Arruda during his master's degree with the collaboration of other authors. The title of the research is Person, Environment, Affectivity, and Health Promotion in Community Gardens. Community gardens in urban areas can provide benefits both for the environment and local communities. In Brazil, the implementation and maintenance is the responsibility of the government, which offers technical support. This space can help regulate the local climate and enhance biodiversity, and as a social technology, can boost household income and improve salutogenic settings. However, these areas demonstrate a potential for resting affective bonds and promoting the collectivity. The objective was to analyze the environmental perception and affections of the community gardens program users in a city located in southern Brazil. 40 users were interviewed, mostly retired and over 60 years old. The affective maps generator instrument was developed to capture the effects. People review their perceptions and affectivity in relation to the environment through the production of images and synthesis associated with their feelings and relationship with their surroundings. The content analysis found the perception of an environment that facilitates psychological restoration, mental health, quality of life, social environmental interactions, productivity, health, diet, and family economy. Affection experiences were often described with the intention to identify gardens as a restorative environments and spaces that promote quality of life, which are important mediators of collectivity and the appropriation of environment. The affective map instrument is an important tool that helps to identify affects and the sense attributed to them. The main findings include the perception of community gardens as a restorative environment that promotes distraction, relaxation, and show a complementary concept that contributes to salutogenic setting studies. Thank you very much for your attention.
Ah, it worked pretty well. Thank you, that was very interesting as well.
Yes.
Then we have, okay, number three, Andrew, are you?
Hi, would you like to show the video and see if ours works so well?
Okay, just give me a minute. Not a minute, but it was easier the first one because it was already all done. Okay, I need to. Why is it not opening? Oh, okay. Just kidding. It's gonna work this time. Here. I guess it's this one. So you see it?
Yeah. Thank you, Melissa.
Okay. Go.
So you press play and let it go.
Hello and welcome to our poster on the exploration of the coaching process as a salutogenic intervention in mental health. My name is Sue Jackson and my co-author is Andrew Parsons. Coaching is a process of personal development and it's supporting people to get from where they are in their current situation to where they'd like to be with an enhanced sense of self. And also empowering them to be able to make their own decisions and enable their self-determination. We together have looked at how coaching can impact on people with chronic health conditions. We've worked on this extensively and this paper describes some of these results.
Thanks, Sue. So with a number of years of experience and professional practice in this area, part of our sort of ongoing development is really to sort of fit the coaching process to established principles and frameworks by which we can then further explore and develop our practice. The core areas for our reflective practice have been involved in supporting people with chronic pain, living with and beyond cancer, and neurodegenerative conditions, but also interestingly from supporting others in terms of developing coaching skills to work with these and other populations.
So what we've discovered in our reflective practice together over 5 years or more is that there are key elements that help people to develop resources and to improve their subjective well-being. We provide them in coaching with tools and techniques, with ways to regulate, self-regulate from breathing and mindfulness, and also to be aware of their presence and their self and their impact of self on others. It's the process that involves raising awareness, information, as I say, in the form of resources, and also a learning environment. And through that, we've created a personal leadership framework, which you can see on the slide here, which has at its heart living mindfully, resilience, which is based on salutogenesis, self-development, and working together.
So in summary, our reflections really embed coaching as a salutogenic learning approach, which develops personal skills, attitudes, and beliefs, not only regarding empowerment, but as well as their ability to cope. And you can read more about this work in a recent publication, Empowerment in Health and Wellness.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, that was very interesting. Wow. That's incredible, everything that can be done through a salutogenic approach. So fourth, so it's Ivonette, have you joined us? Not sure. So is there anybody you know her or know if she's about to join us or not? Okay, so I propose going to the fifth one, which would be the Claudia one. So Claudia, I'm gonna share it as well.
Yes, thank you.
Good. Okay, I'm getting better every time. Okay, press play.
The depth psychology-based hypnotherapy helps the patient to recover the sense of coherence through hypnosis. A great number of diseases have their origin in their first years due to lack of coherence between the intrinsically healthy nature of the person and a disturbance with external factors. This is due to the fact that the early impregnations, like for instance the parents' expectations, education, or culture, inhibit the natural development of a healthy nature because they have to accept, adapt to expected behavior. Unborn babies until early childhood do not yet fully possess the capacity to filter and apprehend all internal and external information. They are still in a deep hypnotic state, which means they are still unconscious. Especially negative impregnations remain anchored unconsciously as a trauma. And when they are triggered, they cause unconscious and unwanted reactions that can result in feelings of inadequacy or unhealthy patterns which lead to re-traumatization or disease. With the depth psychology-based hypnotherapy, what we do is that the patient goes into a so-called conscious hypnosis, into his past, visiting or revisiting his history of life or a period of his life, while at the same time the adult or the present person is like the witness of the situation. Then they go to revisit the situation, and through different hypnosis techniques, we expand the awareness of the situation so they can unblock the emotional situation as they had it in their brain, anchored like this. Once they have solved the situation, they create a so-called guiding sentence. And this guiding sentence, they bring it back into the present time. This they will be practicing between the sessions, repeating it constantly in a state of trance or meditation, autogenic training or other methods. And this helps them on one part to increase their sense of awareness or consciousness, at the same time to decrease the level of unconsciousness. And with this, they start discovering more and more their true intrinsically healthy nature. By applying this in the daily life, they will start living a coherent way, the way which is the right one for them. The result of this, when they have recovered the individual sense of coherence, will mean that their quality of life improves because they regain this intrinsically healthy nature and they live more consciously. Physically and psychologically, they improve, and with it, of course, the sense of happiness and fulfillment. Thank you.
Wow, that's very impressive, everything that we can say in only 3 minutes. That was very interesting as well. Now, just want to go back, see if Ivonette is here. Still don't see her. So I would let Julie sharing your own pre-recorded video, if you don't mind.
I didn't send it to you because I thought that the conference maybe have sent it, but I'll show it right now, hopefully.
Just sharing a PowerPoint, so this is the good news.
Okay, fingers crossed there's sound on then.
Hello everyone, my name is Julie Melgaard and I'm from Steno Diabetes Center Copenhagen. I would like to thank the conference for the opportunity to share my findings from the study called Positivity, Optimism and Mental Health in Families with Type 2 Diabetes, an empirical and theoretical study exploring protective factors through positive psychology and salutogenesis. So people with type 2 diabetes live with several challenges, which may enhance the risk of poor mental and physical health. However, despite living with a chronic illness, some individuals manage to live a life with both positivity and well-being. And therefore, the objective of this study was to examine intra and interpersonal protective factors for good mental health and resources leading to thriving. 18 semi-structured family interviews were analyzed using systematic text condensation with the concepts of both sense of coherence and upward and downward spirals as the analytical framework. And the analysis revealed 3 overall findings, where the first one was that type 2 diabetes is perceived as manageable due to a general optimism despite living with a chronic illness. And a man to a wife with diabetes says, "I don't think it takes up as much space anymore as it did in the past. It's also because we've found a way where it becomes more and more positive." So participants with a positive mindset were more likely to perceive their diabetes as manageable and to seek the resources needed to face their illness. And the second finding was that establishing supportive social relations means having the opportunity to share the burden of diabetes. And here, a wife of a man with diabetes says, "It's not very fun if you're all alone and must figure out your food and everything, and the rest of us just continue as normal. It doesn't make any sense. We're all in this together." So this quote shows how diabetes became shared through family members making dietary changes for the whole family, and how peer and family support may look like. But one thing is to have social relations, another thing is to make use of them, which leads us to the last finding, which is achieving an open dialogue and communicating the difficulties of diabetes without straining surroundings with negative illness communication. And here a family member says, "We talk about it, but it's not something we think about all the time and worry about. I don't think it affects me that much." So this family found a balance with communication about the illness, which made the burden of diabetes less heavy. So the goal is to help people with diabetes create meaning with their illness and use of the social environment through dialogue and communication in order to increase positivity, optimism, and mental health. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So since I think we have a bit more time, since we only had a 5 out of 6 poster presentation, we're going to take this free time maybe to ask some questions or comments or reflections on your own about the several and very nice presentation that we just had. Any comment or questions? Because I would have one maybe to all of you, but maybe more specifically to Ruth, because I work in the field of climate change, and I thought it was very interesting the way you analyze this kind of relationships that people, persons have with their environment. So maybe to you and other speakers, so what do you think about, you know, with all the adversity that is expected to grow with climate change, you know, eco-anxiety and all the psychosocial impacts of the future crisis. So how do you think this kind of approach or any other approach based on salutogenic theory could help us to, you know, be increase our resilience toward climate change?
Me too, because I, as I said, I work at two programs of master's, post-graduation, and my aim is to integrate health, promoting health and sustainability. I am part of the Brazilian Association of Environmental Psychology. We have a group in environmental psychology, and in this group we work to develop tools to evaluate this perception, this relation with the environment. Because we know that it's very difficult to evaluate only by scales, so questionnaires. So we work with photos, we work with draws. These participants, they had to draw the garden where they worked. And through this draw, they could explain, they could express their feelings, what they think about that experience in that place. And it was very important to facilitate this the access to the their experience, what they are living there, because this program in Brazil, in my city, it is very important, because these adults, they had problems with mental health problems, they had depression, and since it started, this project, it contributed very much to improve their health, their mental health. What I am presenting this work is try to approximate environmental psychology to salutogenesis. So if you have interest, I like very much to study more this way to think climate change, because this subject still is new here in Brazil. I perceived that in Europe and United States and Canada, you studied for a long time, more time than us. And we are beginning this study here. And you must know by the media, the great problem is happening in Brazil, in Pantanal, in Amazonia. And it's very, very important that salutogenesis be working, studying more and together about the subject, and the environmental psychology can contribute to this. And the area of studies we call relations, person environmental relations, this area of study. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Very nice.
I'm going to I'm going to let my research here, the link of my paper in the chat for you.
Oh yeah, good, good. Go ahead. So would you have any questions or comments about any of the presentation? So
maybe just to add to your question, Melissa, if I may, because I think the environment is so important for all of us, and I think one of the words that really resonated with me from your presentation, Julie, was open communication, and that seemed to be a theme through many of the presentations for me at least. It's just that ability to have an open conversation, which is free from the pain or the illness or disease, and focused more towards finding ways to manage and cope and find meaning. And nature in itself can provide a lot of meaning for people in our work, even just holding conversations in nature and supporting people to notice what's going on around them can always produce meaning. But I think there's also a subtext to your question, which is, what are we going to do with the climate crisis as professionals? In the coaching world, there is quite a body of work at the moment, which is raising the question of an ethical responsibility for us as professionals to at least raise the conversation with people so that they're aware there is a conversation to be had. Irrespective of their belief system or whether they believe in climate change or not, but actually raising that conversation, I think, it comes back to that open communication. And I think that's such an important thing for us all to do.
And based on a salutogenic approach, so I'm on a much more positive way. So rather than only seeing problems and just contributing to increase eco-anxiety in your youth, maybe we could try to cultivate optimism and positivity and all of the things that you've been mentioning. So I think combining these two things all together is very, very promising.
What can be done? Absolutely.
And maybe I just have a last question, but at the same time, I need to be on another session at 7:25. But I was just wondering, because you've been talking about very nice individual approaches, integrating a salutogenic theory. But do you think that this works as well when you're older than when you're younger? So what about the effectiveness according to age groups? That's a pretty big question, but I was just wondering if it only works in young people, it's also effective in older ones.
In our cohort, we've worked across the spectrum of ages. And I think perhaps what's important from my practice as a professional is I need to change my language depending on who I'm talking to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about others? Because hypnotherapy, the with diabetes, families, because I don't know, I had in mind that maybe older people have had more experience in their past, and maybe it's a bit easier to work on your sense of coherence. And I was just wondering if young people have this easiness to go deeper and try to make sense out of something and cultivate all this hope and optimism. So I don't know, that's a question.
Can I say something on this?
Of course, of course.
Yes, so with the hypnotherapy, we also work with the different stages of ages. What we change is, like Andrew was saying before, we change the language with which we speak. So when an older person or an elderly person, of course, has a much more life experience, but is kind of more far away from its coherent intrinsical, so the natural intrinsical nature than a child. And so we change the language, or we use more of a symbolic language with children, sometimes using some imagery. And with adults, then we work consistently with the life analysis, with the history, so the bibliography of the person. And so we can adapt it to all ages very well. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so I'm going to have to leave you to go to the other session, and I invite you to do the same thing. So at 1:30, we're going to have oral sessions, a couple of ones. And Let's see you there. Then after, I think there's the plenary session and everything. So I just hope you're going to enjoy the rest of your day. And again, thank you very much for these excellent poster presentation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, everyone. Good to meet you all.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.